KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Israel launched a strike against Iran, killing military leaders and bombing nuclear sites. Iran is retaliating. How much farther can this round of strikes go? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. President Trump this morning warned that things would get worse if Iran does not sign a new nuclear deal. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. In this hour, we'll ask Israel's UN Ambassador Danny Danon about the next steps. Also, ahead of Father's Day, what can Plato and Aristotle tell us about being a dad? It is Friday, June 13th. On this day in 1966, the Supreme Court ruled that evidence from police interrogations cannot be used in court unless suspects are told about their rights to not answer questions and to have a lawyer. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Israel continues to attack sites in Iran today. These attacks target Iranian nuclear enrichment facilities and military sites. Israel says it has also killed three top Iranian military leaders. NPR's Hadil Al-Shelchi reports Israel says its spy agency helped plan the attacks.
Israel's spy agency, known as the Mossad, smuggled weapons into Iran ahead of its attack on the country, according to Israeli security officials. In a briefing to reporters, the officials said a base for launching explosive drones was established inside Iran and that the drones were activated to target missile launchers at another base near Tehran. Israel had smuggled precision weapons into central Iran and positioned them near surface-to-air missile systems and had deployed strike systems on vehicles. Both were activated as the attack began in order to target Iran's defenses. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
President Trump is writing online about Israel's attacks. This morning, he said that he had given Iran a 60-day ultimatum to make a deal on its nuclear program. He says that today is day 61. The United States has been holding a series of talks with Iran on its program. Representatives from both sides were supposed to meet this weekend in Oman, but Iranian state media say those talks are off. Democrats are calling the forcible removal and detainment of U.S. Senator Alex Padilla an assault by the Trump administration. NPR's Claudia Grisales reports that the Senate's Republican leader is investigating yesterday's incident.
Colleagues of California Democratic Senator Alex Padilla are demanding answers after he was forced to the ground during a press conference for Homeland Security Secretary Christine Noem. Senate Majority Leader John Thune, a Republican like Noem of South Dakota, told reporters he's not jumping to any conclusions before announcing his next steps.
But we want to get the full scope of what happened and do what we would do on any incident like this involving a senator, and let's try to gather all the relevant information.
However, Thune's Republican counterpart at the other side of the Capitol is not waiting. House Speaker Mike Johnson said Padilla acted wildly inappropriate and should be censured. Claudia Gonzalez, NPR News.
The House of Representatives has voted to strip the Corporation for Public Broadcasting of all federal funding for the next 2 years. The legislation passed in the House by two votes. NPR's David Folkenflik reports Republican sponsors acted on a request by President Trump to claw back the funding.
What we're looking at is $1.1 billion, small change in the grand scheme of things, but that was to fund public broadcasting, all of it, mostly local public television and radio stations for the next 2 years.
NPR's David Folkenflik reporting the measure now goes to the Senate. This is NPR. There is only one survivor from yesterday's massive crash of an Air India jet in western India. 241 other people on the plane perished when the Boeing 787 Dreamliner sank only seconds after takeoff. It crashed into buildings from a medical college. People on the ground were also killed. Authorities say the passenger who survived does not have life-threatening injuries. The Department of Health and Human Services says it stands by a fact sheet sent to members of Congress that critics argue contains false claims about vaccines. Jackie Fortier with KFF Health News has more.
The Health and Human Services memo cites scientific studies that are unpublished and under academic dispute. It mischaracterizes others. It was sent to members of Congress to back up Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s decision to change U.S. policy on COVID vaccines.
This is just nonsense.
Sean O'Leary is an assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Colorado. He says the citations give it a false appearance of scientific rigor, which could mislead lawmakers.
The problem is a lot of legislators and even their staffers, they don't have the expertise to be able to pick those references apart.
In response, HHS defended the document.
That's KFF's Jackie Fortier reporting. The NHL Stanley Cup Final is now tied at 2 games apiece. The Edmonton Oilers beat the Florida Panthers last night 5-4 in overtime. Meanwhile, Game 4 of the NBA Championship is tonight. The Indiana Pacers will host the Oklahoma City Thunder. Indiana leads the series 2-1. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Lemelson Foundation, dedicated to improving lives through invention, innovation, and climate action. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at wtgrantfdn.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. People in Iran's capital heard explosions overnight and soon learned their country was under attack. The Israeli military affirms that it struck dozens of Iranian targets, including nuclear facilities. Iranian state media say that some of its top generals and nuclear scientists were killed. Now, this is a story with a lot of moving parts. The United States says it was not involved in this attack by a U.S. ally. But at the same time, President Trump is saying Iranian leaders should sign a new nuclear agreement to limit their nuclear program before they suffer worse damage. NPR's Hadil Alshalchi is covering this from Tel Aviv. Good morning.
Good morning.
Who is saying what as you and I are talking now?
Well, let's start with the Israeli military. It announced that it actually completed a large-scale airstrike campaign in western Iran. It includes also the capital, Tehran. But Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz has said there will be more attacks. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel targeted Iran's main nuclear enrichment facility called Natanz, and Iran says that it did suffer damage. Both militaries also said that 3 top Iranian security chiefs were killed, including the Iranian military chief of staff, Mohammad Bagheri. That's a major blow to Iran's military chain of command, of course. So that's going to put a wrench into those negotiations. Iran's supreme leader said Israel should expect a, quote, harsh punishment. And Israel said that Iran fired about 100 drones at Israel.
Really striking results, particularly since there'd been many signs that this attack might be coming and the Israelis still had this effect. What is it like in Israel this morning as people wait for a response?
Well, we actually all woke up pretty early, around 3 a.m. Local time, to sirens across the country. It wasn't because there were any strikes. The Israeli military said they were a preemptive warning to Israelis to get prepared for a, quote, major threat. The Ben-Gurion airport is closed, but all morning we could hear fighter jets overhead in the sky. This morning I went to the grocery store. It was full of people stocking up on water, other supplies just in case. Schools and public gatherings like the Tel Aviv Pride Parade today are also canceled.
The timing of this is really notable. What else is happening at this moment when Israel chose to strike?
I mean, this is all happening as the U.S. and Iran have been actually holding talks for weeks now. They're trying to strike a deal that would see Iran scale down on its nuclear program in exchange for the U.S. lifting sanctions. Those sanctions have crippled Iran's economy.
Yeah.
And so Netanyahu has been adamant the entire time that the only way to stop Iran from developing a nuclear weapon is by war. Iran insists that it doesn't want to develop a nuclear weapon. But then last month, the U.N.'s nuclear watchdog said that Iran actually had enough enriched uranium to theoretically develop a weapon. And then this week, the same watchdog, for the first time in 20 years, censored Iran over not complying with its inspections. But Iran is defiant. It also announced that it would start a third enrichment site in the country.
How is the United States responding to this overnight news?
So until just yesterday, President Trump signaled that a strike on Iran was possible but not imminent. And then today on social media, he warned Iran that it will, quote, only get worse, and urged Tehran to make a deal, quote, before there is nothing left. After the attack earlier this morning, the State Department said it was informed by Israel that it would strike. It said Israel carried it out unilaterally and that the U.S. was not involved. And then the U.S. envoy, Steve Witkoff, was due to meet with the Iranian negotiating team in Oman on Sunday. But of course, now Iran said it won't be going.
NPR's Adil Al-Shalchi has the latest from Tel Aviv. Thanks very much for the update and your insights. Really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Throughout this morning, we've been covering Israel's strikes on Iran. We've had reporting from the region, analysis from Washington and elsewhere. We'll continue. That's what you get from NPR News. Our next guest is Danny Danon, Israel's ambassador to the United Nations, who's on the line. Ambassador, welcome back to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me, Steve.
What, in Israel's view, justified an attack on another country at this time?
Well, we obtained the information about the secret program that they included all the necessary parts to put together a bomb. You know, we're talking about the uranium enrichment, the triggering mechanisms, and the warhead delivery systems. And like you mentioned earlier, the IAEA decided and reported that Iran possesses enough material for multiple nuclear weapons. So we decided to take a preemptive attack, and not to wait, and not to be surprised. After October 7th, we learned that lesson. We are not going to wait for our enemies to surprise us again. That's why we targeted the nuclear sites and also the industry of the ballistic missiles that Iran developed.
Well, let's talk about the information that you say you obtained about an Iranian secret program, the various components of a bomb. We will note that Iran always denies they have any ambition to build a nuclear weapon, although they insist that they have the right to a nuclear program. You are asserting that they had the capability together. Are you asserting that they were on their way to making a bomb, or only that the secret program had the capacity to do so?
No, moreover, we have the intelligence that it wasn't like a nuclear reactor for civil usage. It was a military program that was hidden from the international community. And once we realize that they are playing the game and they are getting very close to the point of no return, we couldn't take that risk. You know, a few hours ago, they sent more than 100 drones. Mm-hmm. We expect ballistic missiles to fly into Israel in the next few days. So we cannot wait for the day that they will actually be able to put the nuclear capability on those ballistic missiles that they have already.
I just want to make sure that I understand what you're saying, though. You're saying they had this program for building a nuclear weapon. Was Iran actively assembling a nuclear weapon, according to your intelligence?
Absolutely. They were moving forward. And I think what we realize that now, when they have enough uranium, they have the technology. And you know what? We believed them. They said very clearly, we will destroy the Jewish nation. They didn't hide it. So we decided not to take that chance. History have taught us that when you have a regime which threatens to annihilate the Jewish people, we better believe them. And that's why we took this preemptive attack, to make sure that we will not be in a point that Iran will be able to implement those radical ideas.
Do you have any initial assessment as to whether you successfully damaged or destroyed the nuclear facilities, some of which would be well underground?
Well, you know, it's too early to call it. You know, it's a long operation. It's going to be very intense in Israel in the next few days. We expect retaliation, and we will continue. You know, we have the ability to attack targets in Iran today. We will continue until we will be sure that Iran is not in a position of posing a threat to Israel and to the Western societies.
When you say you're going to continue, I want to understand what the rhythm is here. Are you suggesting that what Israel will do is assess the damage, decide if more strikes are needed, and then strike further as you judge? Is that what you see ahead?
Well, I will not go into details, but, you know, once we decided to take those actions, we realized the consequences. But for the future generations, we took that decision in order to allow Israel to survive. And that's why we are determined to finish the job, to make sure that Iran will not be a threat, not only to Israel. You know, they are threatening many allies of the U.S. in the region. I think now it's about time to create a new reality.
Ambassador, I want to keep you on the line for another couple of minutes to ask where the United States fits into this. We'll recall that President Trump had been trying for an agreement to limit or eliminate Iran's nuclear program. The strike comes just as the U.S. was preparing for another round of talks. What relationship is there, if any, in the timing? Did you consider the United States' position in deciding on the timing here?
Well, we have an ongoing dialogue with our colleagues in D.C., but this decision was made in Jerusalem. It was an independent decision of Israel. We decided that we cannot wait anymore. It was an act of self-defense. And I want to remind you, Steve, you know, it happened in the past. In the 80s, Prime Minister Begin took a similar decision to attack the nuclear reactor in Iraq. We were isolated for a while. We were condemned by the UN and other international institutions. But when you look at it for today, you realize it was the right decision. Same with our attack against a nuclear reactor in Syria. So I think what we did there last night was a historic decision that will make the world a safer place for everybody.
President Trump, though, has urged Iran again this morning to take the opportunity to make a deal. He's effectively said this attack is a warning. You'd better act before you lose everything. Hurry up and make a deal. Does Israel want the United States to make an agreement over Iran's nuclear program with Iran?
Well, we look at the end results. You know, we want to have a situation where we can live peacefully. You know, when you look at the map, you see the distance between Iran and Israel. We have no dispute with the Iranian people whatsoever. You know, no borders, no conflict. It's only the radical ideology that leads them to spend billions of dollars against Israel, providing it to the proxies and building the ballistic missiles. And if you will allow me, I will elaborate on that. Iran wanted to reach a position that they will have the same amount of ballistic missiles like the United States in order to threaten Israel. So it was an imminent threat. That's why we took this action.
And just to be clear, we've got about 10 seconds. Do you want the United States to make a nuclear agreement with Iran?
So we want to get to a position that there is no threat against Israel. If you can achieve it diplomatically, we always prefer that. But we saw in the last few decades that the Iranians lied. They played the game, but at the same time, they continued to build their capabilities.
Danny Danon is Israel's ambassador to the United Nations. He's on the line this morning. Ambassador, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Steve.
And we'll continue covering Israel's strike on Iran's nuclear facilities. Israel saying it hit dozens of targets, and we'll have more throughout the day. This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember Brian Wilson, founder of the Beach Boys. He wrote and produced many of their songs, including In My Room and God Only Knows, which Paul McCartney called the greatest song ever written. Wilson struggled with his mental health and found solace in music. We'll listen back to two interviews with him. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at Viking.com. From BetterHelp, committed to helping clients with issues ranging from relationship challenges and goal setting to grief and depression. Learn more at BetterHelp.com/public. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. This Father's Day weekend, fathers can reflect on how we do the job. Writer Augustine Sedgwick studied fathers in history, like England's Henry VIII, who went to extremes to father a male heir, or founding father Thomas Jefferson, who fathered children both free and enslaved. Sedgwick says the idea of fathers as providers or the men in charge has changed over time. His book is Fatherhood, and I asked what got him thinking about it.
My father was just so present all of my life. He was solid and forthright and a source of really good advice and, you know, crisp 20s when needed. Right not long before my own son was born, my father had a stroke that really changed his personality. And my son was born in the summer of 2017, which was kind of a tough moment for men and fatherhood. I mean, when we got to the hospital, Bill Cosby's mistrial was on every TV in the maternity ward.
Wow.
You know, America's dad. But not long before that, you know, Trump had been inaugurated and he had boasted of never having changed a diaper, but also how much he loved it when his adult daughter called him daddy. And so I couldn't help thinking at that moment that the fathers I had grown up with no longer existed in the way that I had known them. And I wanted to find a way to care for my son that felt good and sustainable for both of us. You know, that's not really the type of question that is addressed by parenting books, even the most helpful ones.
You describe a number of figures in history, famous figures in history, and talk about them in terms of fatherhood. I'd never thought of Aristotle or Plato as fathers. What's going on there?
At a moment of crisis for Athens and its democracy, Plato and Aristotle had what I think is probably the first recorded debate about what it means to be a father. So both of them agreed that because these crises were plaguing Athens, fatherhood needed to be redefined. Plato in the Republic proposed a kind of thought experiment where the patriarchal family would be abolished and everyone would come to think of themselves as one family the size of the state. His student Aristotle profoundly disagreed, and he thought fatherhood needed to be strengthened by policies that would help fathers identify with their children and kind of reclaim their positions of power and authority both in the household and beyond it.
I'm interested in hearing you talk because this is one of many examples in the book where we're talking about a family unit, but we end up also talking about the state or the country, the organization of the whole society.
Across time, fatherhood has been created as this kind of godlike paternal mandate to protect and provide. What's interesting about that is that men, of course, are not gods. Therefore, men time and time again find themselves in crises of masculinity, of fatherhood, because they have defined those ideas in terms that are effectively impossible to completely guarantee and fulfill.
What was the common definition of fatherhood in the United States in the mid-20th century, say, a couple generations ago?
In the Cold War context, the idea of fatherhood shifts. This is a moment when the dad emerges on the scene, and the dad is a really novel figure who is not only a protector and a provider, but also a friend. someone who comes home after work and plays with his kids and goes to Little League and, you know, is a force for kind of positivity and happiness in the household. But it also kind of adds to the, I want to say, impossible standards that have been built into this idea of fatherhood for reasons that are related to the family, but also related to society and the state more generally.
I'm interested in hearing you say that, because it's often said that women face impossible standards and conflicting demands of work and home and everything else. You're telling me that men do, that fathers do.
Absolutely. I think women also do. They're just much better at talking about it. I mean, the founders of second wave feminism, especially Simone de Beauvoir, were very clear about the idea that motherhood and womanhood had been, quote unquote, man-made, that they had been invented, they had changed over time, and they had constrained women in certain ways. I think men would make their lives better if we could understand that fatherhood had been invented and that it had changed over time and that it could be remade again. I think men would do themselves a favor. But men have been much slower to kind of pick up the thread of that inquiry and to look at, well, where did this idea come from? How has it changed? And how might its history help us understand where we could go next?
Has your exploration of all that history changed your day-to-day fathering?
I certainly started the book because I wanted to find a way to connect with my father, and I wanted to find a way to care for my son that felt good to us. I was finishing the book. I actually felt frustrated that I hadn't found what I was looking for. And around that time I was walking with my son, I thought for the first time to ask him what he thought a father should be. And without missing a beat, he told me that a father should be funny and good at hugging. And I have to be honest with you, at first I was disappointed by that answer too, because...
What do you mean too? I love this answer. Please continue.
I thought he was talking about his mother, and who is genuinely both of those things. And it was only after thinking about it for, I'm embarrassed to say, a couple weeks, that I realized that I just hadn't learned to think of myself as a man and as a father in those terms.
You studied Sigmund Freud and Henry VIII, and what you really needed to be doing was reading books of knock-knock jokes.
You know, father doesn't always know best. Father should maybe just listen to...
Just listen to the kids, see what comes out. They're not always right, but they're ruthlessly honest, that's for sure.
Listen to what the people you love are asking you to do and allow yourself to be loved in that way. I think that'd be really transformative for me and for men more generally.
Augustine Sedgwick is the author of Fatherhood, A History of Love and Power. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Climate change shouldn't just be a factor in how we construct buildings. It's also starting to influence how we tear them down.
Typically what happens is a bulldozer will come in, smash it all. It'll all get trashed. But deconstruction, we try to salvage and recycle as much as possible.
I'm Elsa Chang. How taking apart a building piece by piece helps reduce planet warming pollution. On the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. NATO's Secretary General is calling for de-escalation after Israel launched airstrikes across Iran today, targeting Tehran's nuclear and military sites.
It is crucial for many allies, including the United States, to work as we speak to de-escalate. I know they're doing that.
Mark Rutte was speaking in Stockholm. Iran responded by launching drones at Israel and canceling plans to attend weekend talks in Oman over its nuclear program. The National Transportation Safety Board says it will be assisting with the investigation into yesterday's crash of an Air India Boeing 787 Dreamliner. It went down in a residential area of western India moments after taking off from the airport in Ahmedabad. 241 people aboard the jet were killed, as were dozens more on the ground. One person aboard the jet survived, as Villa Marx reports from London, where Flight 171 was headed.
The air accident's sole survivor was a British national, authorities have confirmed, but the airline says 52 other UK citizens died when the aircraft plummeted soon after takeoff. Leaders of several British Indian communities have paid tribute to those who died, including two young parents and their four-year-old child from the west of England.
Authorities in India now say they've recovered the flight data recorder from a rooftop near the crash site. This is NPR News. Later today, the state of South Carolina is scheduled to execute a death row inmate convicted of two murders. The 57-year-old was found guilty of fatally shooting a friend and then stealing money from his bank account. Hours later, prosecutors say Stephen Stanko killed his girlfriend and raped her daughter. A judge in Maryland says jurors in Baltimore awarded too much money in the city's successful opioid lawsuit. Scott Massioni with member station WYPR reports that ruling lowers payments to the city from drug distributors McKesson and AmerisourceBergen.
Baltimore City Circuit Judge Lawrence Fletcher Hill ruled that a jury awarded the city too much in liability and punitive damages for the role the two companies played in the opioid crisis. The judge is suggesting a payment of $52 million, down from the original $266 million. He also offered the city the option for a retrial. The jury found McKesson and AmerisourceBergen liable for their role in the opioid crisis in Baltimore last year. Baltimore had more overdoses than any major city in recent years and decided to sue the companies individually for damages rather than sign on to a global settlement. For NPR News, I'm Scott Massioni.
The NHL's Stanley Cup Final is tied at two games apiece after last night's 5-4 overtime win by the Edmonton Oilers over the Florida Panthers. Game 5 is tomorrow night in Edmonton. On Wall Street in early trading, the Dow's off 420 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. As the Trump administration ramps up immigration enforcement, farm workers are reporting raids and arrests. This week, federal agents swept through farms in California, and last month, agents stopped a bus in upstate New York to detain more than a dozen farm workers. This is all according to the United Farm Workers, and that union's president, Teresa Romero, is on the line with us. So, Teresa, tell us about what you know about these raids. Who exactly is being arrested?
You know, in California, we have received numerous calls from farm workers, from community members, saying that vehicles from immigration are throughout the agricultural area. And that has created a lot of intimidation, stress, distressed, and it is just very sad because they're going after people who work very hard, who are not criminals, and they are responsible for putting food on our tables.
Have you heard, Teresa, if people are afraid to go to work or just have stopped showing up to work at all because they're concerned?
Terrified is a better word to describe it. However, we need to remember that farm workers have seasonal jobs. They need to pay the rent, they need to pay the utilities, they need to feed their family. So even though they're terrified, they're scared, they're showing up to work.
Now, just a note, we did ask the Department of Homeland Security to confirm that the raids happened, but a spokesperson declined to answer our questions. Now, your union advised agricultural employers to harden work sites. What does that mean? What does it mean to harden a work site?
We need to make sure that if ICE is going to show up, right now, there's no transparency on what they're doing. So they're driving, they see people, to be honest with you, they see people of color, see brown people, they're just taking them. We don't know who they are, they don't know why, they don't have a search warrant. So what we're trying to do is make sure that they understand that they need to do it in a way that is legal. Just show up and go in the fields to do whatever they want. You know, that's not constitutional. That's not who we are as a country.
But why should employers help workers without legal status? Why not tell employers to cooperate with authorities? After all, the employers are going to be there, and what if they face some kind of retribution?
What we need to make sure is that everybody is afforded the constitutional rights. If you are going to take me, it's because you have an arrest warrant. You have some document that a judge has signed that says that you can take me.
Do you have specific examples of what happens to farms after ICE comes and arrests workers?
We have spoken with some employers that said, yes, we let the workers go. They were terrified. We had spoken with people that says, yes, you know, the next day, only half of the workers showed up. But then the day after, everybody is there. We have spoken with small farms that say, if they come to my farm, and if we have here undocumented workers and they take them, I'm going to be out of business.
Trump did say, though, as a candidate, that if he became president, there would be mass deportations. So how surprised should we be at what we're seeing?
Very surprised, because he said that he would be deporting criminals. And let me tell you where you find the criminals: in prisons. They have been given the opportunity to be charged, tried, found guilty by a jury, and sentenced by a judge. They have already went through the process that we all should go through when we're charged with something. He did say that he was going to deport criminals. He's not deporting criminals. He's deporting hardworking farm workers.
Now, President Trump posted on social media about farmers, quote, "Our very aggressive policy on immigration is taking very good long-time workers away," and that this is, quote, "not good." What do you make of that quote?
You know, that's a statement that he makes several statements on social media. I'm the type of person, my saying is a show, don't tell. If he believes that and he's in charge, he can stop this rate right now.
What do you hope that in a couple of months that we can all kind of figure out from what has happened?
You know, I would hope that people would understand and would put themselves in the position of these hardworking people. But if they don't want to do it for the benefit of human beings and their families, then they need to start thinking about what is going to happen when they go to the market the next time. Right now, every time you go to the market, you find your fruits, your vegetables, your dairy, your meat, your chicken. It is going to be the time that they're not going to be there, and whatever is there is going to be very expensive. I wish they would think about the human loss, but if they don't want to think about that, those are going to be the consequences, and there's going to be crops rotting in the fields. And again, this is something that Trump can stop right now.
Teresa Romero is president of the United Farm Workers Union. Teresa, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Protesters in cities across the country have been demonstrating this week against President Trump's immigration raids and his military response in Los Angeles. In Texas, Governor Greg Abbott ordered more than 5,000 Texas National Guard troops and more than 2,000 state police to help local law enforcement manage planned protests this weekend. Dan Katz reports from Texas Public Radio.
Abbott's announcement did not detail where the troops were sent across the state, but some were seen arriving at a downtown San Antonio hotel on Wednesday night. The governor says that peaceful protests are, quote, part of the fabric of our nation, but the guardsmen were mobilized to assist local law enforcement's response to the protests. Large-scale protests are planned on Saturday across Texas in cities like Houston, Austin, Dallas, and San Antonio as part of the national No Kings movement. Organizers already in San Antonio say the show of force is meant to intimidate ahead of Saturday's protests, but they're not backing down. Organizer Juan Castaneda spoke to protesters who turned out in San Antonio on Wednesday night.
Your voice means way more than you think. There's people that are struggling, that fight so hard to have this voice, that are hiding in houses, finding shelter. And we have a voice that they fight so hard to do. I'll be damned if I let my voice go to waste. Yeah!
Recent demonstrations in Texas have been mostly peaceful, but tensions have flared at times. In Austin, more than a dozen people were arrested after hundreds gathered at the Texas Capitol, and police in Dallas fired pepper balls at demonstrators and made one arrest. In San Antonio, the guardsmen did not interact with some protesters who turned out on the streets near the Alamo on Wednesday night, and no violence was reported. San Antonio Police Chief William McManus says Abbott did not coordinate with local officials on the National Guard deployment. He says his department has its own way of handling protests.
Were there initially to protect the constitutional rights to express First Amendment.
Abbott did not respond to requests for comment. In a statement this week, the governor said that Texas would not tolerate the, quote, lawlessness we've seen in Los Angeles. The governor deployed Texas guardsmen to the border with Mexico back in 2021 as part of Operation Lone Star to crack down on migrant border crossings. For NPR News, I'm Dan Katz in San Antonio.
This afternoon on All Things Considered, we hear about an Israeli entrepreneur behind a Michelin star restaurant who also represents the controversial group distributing aid at sites in Gaza where people are suffering from extreme hunger. Listen on a smart speaker in the NPR app or on this public radio station. This is NPR News. A new study finds that a basic exercise regime improves survival rates and health outcomes for colon cancer patients. Fitness and cancer, next time in Here and Now.
Big news stories don't always break on your schedule, but with the NPR app, news, culture, and podcasts are ready when you want them, in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. Chinese banks are struggling to make money. They're paying depositors almost nothing. What to do? Labubu to the rescue, for a minute anyway. Labubu are furry dolls with big eyes, a big grin, and nine teeth. They've gotten wildly popular recently. One bank in China offered a doll to customers willing to keep about $7,000 on deposit for 3 months. Bloomberg reports there was strong interest from customers, but Chinese regulators shut it down, saying offering perks like that just pushes up costs. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. There is a lone survivor after one of the worst aviation accidents in the history of India. An Air India flight bound for London crashed into a medical college shortly after departure on Thursday. At least 249 people were killed. But let's focus on the one who was not. NPR's Dia Hadid is in Mumbai. Hi, Dia.
Hi there, Steve.
This is incredible. You would presume, that's the way I think about it, if this plane goes down, everyone will die with it. That's a reasonable assumption, but in this case, there was one survivor. What was his story?
It seems almost miraculous. As you say, he was the passenger in seat 11A, and he somehow managed to escape out of the emergency exit after the plane hit the medical college and burst into flames from the, and that happened just moments after it had taken off from the airport in the northwestern city of Ahmedabad. And there was video circulating after the crash where this fellow, who was visibly wounded, dazed and confused, clutching his mobile phone, just walks out of the crash site. Now, we know who he is now. He's 40-year-old British citizen Vishwakumar Ramesh, and he's in hospital now receiving psychiatric care. As for everybody else, authorities are undertaking DNA tests on relatives to identify the bodies. This was an enormous blast.
And I would imagine that the casualties were not only on the plane, given that it struck buildings.
That's right. In an unfortunate coincidence, at that medical college, there were students who gathered for lunch, and so seven people were killed there, including five medical students. It also killed a 15-year-old who delivered lunch to his mum, who was running a roadside tea stall nearby.
So what else is known about people who were on the plane other than the sole survivor?
Well, I think what it tells us is a little bit about Ahmedabad, the city that this crash happened in, and the state, Gujarat. There are so many people here who live abroad. It has a huge expatriate population. Mm. And you can see that in the stories of the victims. One man on the plane was with his wife and a little girl. They were returning home to England after visiting his parents. Another man was returning home after his father's funeral. It also included an Indian company director who was on the flight with his wife to visit his sister in London. And we caught up with his colleague, Samira Desai.
It's a tragedy and how fragile life can be. There's no assurance about the next moment what's going to happen.
In this case, you have a plane that takes off. There's video. It seems normal. Then it starts losing altitude. Then it hits the ground with an explosion. Any idea why?
Yeah, Indian investigators are trying to assess the cause, and they're getting help from the US National Transportation Safety Board and British investigators. But an aviation safety expert, Amit Singh, told us there may have been issues with the aircraft or even crew, but there's a tendency to hide these problems. He says regulators and operators aren't working well together.
There's a lack of trust, so none of the parties trust each other.
And another expert told Indian outlet News Minute that this crash, whatever the reason, was likely made worse because there's so much development around airports that shouldn't be there. So when there's a problem, pilots can't safely land. This is Mohan Raghunathan.
You cannot have garbage dumps, you can't have slaughterhouses, and so many restrictions are there. And that is violated everywhere.
Now, Indian regulators have not yet responded to those allegations, and the Dreamliner, which was the plane in this flight, has not been involved in an accident like this before.
Okay. Dia, thanks very much for the update. Unbelievable story. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Steve.
NPR's Dia Hadid is in Mumbai. This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Temperatures in Europe are increasing twice as fast as the global average. That's causing more fires and flooding. Copenhagen, for example, expects 30% more rainfall by the end of the century. NPR's Rob Schmitz reports from there on how a city built centuries ago is racing to adapt.
Sometimes a single storm can change a city. For Copenhagen, that storm hit on July 2nd, 2011.
It was over 100 millimeters of rain in a couple of hours fell directly in the city of Copenhagen.
Mark Payne is a climate researcher at the Danish Meteorological Institute. He says more than 5 inches of rain fell on the city in the matter of hours, flooding the Danish capital and filling its streets with raw sewage. Video from the event shows city streets transformed into waterways, passing city buses generating waves that broke against storefronts and relentless torrential rain. Climate scientists like Payne call these events cloudbursts. And he says, on first glance, they appear to be run-of-the-mill thunderstorms.
And a cloudburst is the same mechanism. It just has a lot of water in it. And the winds that go up hold the water up in the air. But at some point, for some reason, that breaks down. And suddenly you've got a whole lot of water sitting in the air that just falls to Earth.
And as the Earth's climate warms, the atmosphere can hold more water, leading to more intense rainfall events like cloudbursts. And Copenhagen is adapting, starting under the city. Engineer Jess Clausen-Koss carefully descends 9 stories of rickety scaffolding along the edge of a massive concrete hole bored into the earth along Copenhagen's harbor. When he reaches the bottom, he tests the acoustics. We are peering inside what's called the Kalvebodbrygge Cloudburst Tunnel, built by Hofor, Denmark's largest utility. It's nearly a mile long, 10 feet in diameter, and it can hold 10,000 cubic meters of water, equal to the volume of 4 Olympic swimming pools. Clausen-Koss says it's one of 7 tunnels dug under Copenhagen to hold excess rainwater. He's overseeing the final phase, which will include installing pumps in the cathedral-like hole where we're standing.
So you're filling up the tunnel? And once it is full, water then will start racing in the streets. You will switch on the pumps with 20 cubic meter per second, and they can simply suck out this and throw it into the harbor.
He says this is part of a $1.3 billion investment to try and make Copenhagen floodproof. The other part, sponge parks. Just blocks away from the Kalvebodbrygge tunnel is Engehaveparken, a century-old park that was redesigned to transform into a massive reservoir in the event of heavy rain. Today, neighborhood children play on a soccer field carved deep into the ground. The whole park is enclosed by a 3-feet-high concrete wall. Gates automatically emerge from the ground, sealing the park so that it can hold floodwater. Jan Rasmussen is director of climate adaptation for the city of Copenhagen. He says storing rainwater on the surface like this makes more sense than expanding the entire sewer system.
You can expand a pipe as easily as this area can be expanded. And it seemed also much cheaper if you can use areas like this to store rainwater.
Rasmussen says Copenhagen has transformed 20 green areas into so-called sponge parks. The city is also building a man-made island off its coast to protect against storm surges, another weather phenomenon happening more often here as the climate warms and sea levels rise. Rasmussen says all of these climate change adaptation projects are attracting attention. He's fielding calls from New York to Buenos Aires to Beijing and beyond, all of them eager to do what they can to prepare for the next flood. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Copenhagen.
You can catch up with all the stories from this series, Rethinking Home, online at npr.org/climateweek.
Support for NPR's Climate Solutions Week, Rethinking Home, comes from the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone, and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR.
Sunday marks 115 years since the first Father's Day. NPR's Anna Perez tells us how it all got started.
For Garrett Martin of Arlington, Texas, this Father's Day is a special one.
I'm looking at my son and thinking, what kind of man do I need to be in order to help him grow into a good man?
Teddy is only 6 months old, and he's completely transformed Martin's life.
It's been really amazing to see the recognition grow in his eyes and see him experience new things. It's really beautiful.
Martin told his wife, Emily, he wanted penny loafers for his first Father's Day. Now, whether you're taking your dad out to dinner or buying him a new grill, the National Retail Federation says Americans are expected to spend a record $24 billion this year. All of this kind of got me wondering, how did Father's Day come to be? So I called up an expert.
Megan Duval, and I am the Historic Preservation Officer for the city and the county of Spokane, Washington.
Duval tells me Father's Day was started by a woman, Sonora Smart Dodd.
She was 16 at the time her mother passed away, and she had five little brothers. And so her father was left a widower.
Duval says Dodd and her father were close because they had to raise such a large family together. One day, she was listening to a church sermon all about mothers.
After the service, she approached the minister and said, you know, that was really lovely, but you didn't mention fathers at all, and I was thinking that maybe we needed a celebration of fathers.
She filed a petition to create one soon after. By the next year, 1910, the first Father's Day was officially celebrated in Spokane. But Sonora Smart Dodd wasn't done promoting the holiday.
She basically sort of partnered up with retailers, associations, merchants, who saw this as an opportunity to sell tobacco and whiskey and ties and a shirt, you know, celebrate your father with a gift.
Duval says Dodd's photo appeared in newspaper ads for dad products in the 1940s. In 1972, the mother of Father's Day got to see her dream come true. The holiday was recognized at the federal level. Over a century since the first celebration, Father's Day takes on many shapes and sizes and can mean different things to different people. For Garrett Martin, it's a day of appreciation.
I think a part of growing up is realizing that your parents are human and realizing all the different ways that they've impacted you and shaped who you are.
For NPR News, I'm Anna Bettis. And he was talking for a new one, and as he grew, he'd say,
I'm gonna be like you, Dad. You know, it's Morning Edition for NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
What da do, da da do, da da do.